You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, it's been a little while since we recorded. I can't remember if we talked about the fact that ABC/Disney took Jimmy Kimmel off the air. Everybody canceled their Disney Plus and Hulu subscriptions. And then the Disney CEO said, we need something, anything to make people like us again. And Jon Favreau was like, I got you. Yeah. He released the Grogu and the Mandalorian trailer.
And that was clearly what fixed everything. So yes. Yeah, there we go. That's look, I'm just happy that that issue was resolved because I've still got to finish watching the Andor series because I'm literally teaching a class on it in January. And I kind of am out over my skis a bit proposing a class where I haven't finished watching the show. So now at least I can do it feeling I'm like a little bit more in the ethical clear.
I still have not renewed my stuff, so I'm going to wait for a while. And normally I watch a lot of things on Hulu. But yeah, I guess it was double the normal amount of churn that month for Disney and Hulu on subscription cancellations.
Focusing on the evils of corporations and how they sort of dominate our world feels like extremely on point for having our buddy Austin Habershaw back on again. Hello. Because this time we are not having a good time in a mall with a genie.
No.
at all. This is very different vibes.
Totally but different. Totally
yeah. Different. So we're talking Faceless Galaxy this time. So welcome back. And all right. So why does this feel maybe more like where we are now than it should?
Oh, you mean Faceless Galaxy?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a book. Well, it's just, you know, so it's a collection of short stories. They're linked short stories. So they're all dealing with the same character set in the same world, told loosely chronologically, or as far as the main character can tell is chronological because of the various physiological issues that it has as the species that it is, but about a sort of amoral universe with no central government in the way that we think of it, and it's like sort of I've been calling it alien noir in the idea that there are no humans, and we're in a totally different universe. But as I was writing them, you know, there have been published 7 of the 10 stories have been published before, most of which have been published in Analog, and a couple other places, and then 3 new ones. So if there happen to be people who are fans of the stories in Analog and have read them all, then they can get even more. These are stories that always have come from a dark place. they're very like the alternative. If Wishes Were Retails, my novel came out this summer, which is, you know, about the genie in the mall, and it's a comedy, and it's heartwarming and lighthearted. And if that's part of my personality, the other one is just dark and brooding and I don't want to go so far as to say nihilistic, because I don't think Faceless is exactly as nihilistic as it thinks it is. But yeah, it is much more, instead of hope for the future, it's more of dismal regard for the present, I guess is the way of putting it.
So I think with regard to Faceless as a character, I think Faceless is an interesting creature, being, entity to consider, because I think we're sitting in this place right now in speculative fiction where, as a collective fandom, many of us kind of fell in love with the "I swear I'm not human, but feels very humanness" of Murderbot.
Yes,
as a kind of like. It feels maybe too extreme to call it a morally gray figure, but it as a figure doesn't think of itself as inhabiting like the same intellectual and emotional universe as human beings. But with Faceless, it's I think we're not probably going to a reader who has kind of been primed for that kind of like, I can handle a character who's not really human, but is sort of in a world that feels human. I don't think they're going to show up to Faceless and get that same vibe.
I feel, first of all, Faceless actively rejects its own personhood in a way that Murderbot doesn't. Like, Murderbot and Faceless would not get along.
Yeah.
They have very similar outlooks in that they are looking in.
Oh, you can pitch an Alien versus Predator, but it's Murderbot versus Faceless. Yeah, well, just go talk to Martha. Very, I'm sure you can make it happen, I'm sure.
Difference. Yeah. that'd be a tough call, honestly. It depends entirely on how good Faceless's sensors are. But yeah, you can always detect Faceless just with a good thermal scan. Faceless is a shapeshifter, for people who don't know, and a shapeshifter that operates on what I hoped were very concrete rules. Faceless rejects its own personhood in the sense that whereas Murderbot is sort of being drawn into human society and like sort of learning to cope with emotions and stuff, Faceless has seen, and again, human used loosely because there are no humans in Faceless's universe. Well, there are, but you haven't met them because they're a lesser race in a small distant planet that no one's been to yet. Thank goodness for us. But Faceless has seen this civilization that it is supposedly supposed to identify with and rejected it wholesale as just bull honky, it's just nonsense. Yeah, yeah. It's like, this is nonsense. I don't want to be part of this. I don't understand why you people want to be part of this. I think the whole thing is messed up and wrong. Including like your, it's, you know, cause like Murderbot also rejects the corporate rim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Faceless would reject the corporate rim and also the, what it would be, it would assume is the sheer hypocrisy of the other people. Who are they from?
Preservation
ops. It's like, no. You're the same shit. Dressed up in a different set of clothing. But the idea that you can exist without being exploitative is nonsense. The world is inherently exploitative. We are all exploiting each other. And it is, it's a very cynical creature, in more so than Murderbot. Murderbot has a softer heart than Faceless does by a lot.
Yeah. So I see why you're saying this is not your feel-good text.
No, not really. You know, I'm very much trying to channel the noirish vibe like people like Raymond Chandler and who else would I throw out there? I mean, it's very modernist.
Yeah.
If we're gonna put a movement on it, in that like it's all about debunking or insisting upon the venal shallowness of all the social structures that we have devised to make us feel better about the fact that we are these essentially apex predators that sit on top mountains of skulls and do what we please, and that Faceless, as a creature from the very bottom of that hierarchy, sees through our crap.
No.
And doesn't want to be part of us. isn't interested.
Look, buddy, if I had a skull in the sense that you think of them, yes. I'm not putting it in this pile for you.
Yes. It is that, and that's part of it. It's physiologically alien as well.
So how long have you been getting to know Faceless? How long do the two of you go back?
Oh, a while. I think my first story I published was probably in like 2014, 2015.
Yeah.
Probably around there. The first one I had out was in Escape Pod. And that was Adaptation and Predation, which is the one at the very beginning of the collection where we kind of meet Faceless and learn how it operates and learn its rules and its general outlook.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with the line, "Everybody lives in somebody else's version of hell." which if we're going to give it a general theme, that's one of the central themes, is everybody lives in some sort of dystopia for somebody else. So I've been getting to know Faceless for quite a long time, and there's an unpublished novel about Faceless that I wrote, and me and my agent were unable to sell, unfortunately. I came really close a bunch of times.
Yeah.
But
You should put it back out now that Murderbot's so popular.
I mean, I don't know, maybe. Hopefully. I do hope someday I'll be able to get it out there. Part of this collection idea was I looked at The Witcher. And I think also if we're going to create character analogies, I do think Geralt and Faceless would have long and productive conversations. I also don't think they'd be friends, but like they also have that outsider perspective of like, well, I guess there's only things that I can do. And in theory, these should make the world better. But as Geralt finds out all the time, no, it doesn't actually. I slay the monster, but the real monster is the king that's hired me in the first place. And I can't slay him as much as I'd like to. And Faceless is like, yeah, man, I get it. I absolutely understand.
Sucks to suck.
Yeah, I know. I feel exactly how you feel. Sapowski, right? Yes.
I think so, yeah.
Sapowski, who's the author of The Witcher, first published The Last Wish, which is a collection of short stories about Geralt and his exploits. And then that led to the novels and then the game. And so I kind of like am doing a similar thing. I don't think I'm going to be, I would love to be as successful with it as Sapowski has been, but I don't know that I will. But that was sort of the idea. It's like, well, I can't get the novel out there right now. So at least I can collect all these stories together and, and give us a look at this universe that I've been building for about a decade, maybe a little more. That all circle around the shapeshifter.
I think the idea of interconnected and sort of like these stories that are linked in that they are all Faceless's stories and in that they exist in this universe that you've been developing is a really interesting way of kind of threading a needle between, I think most readers are more accustomed to reading long form fiction than they are short stories. I think folks who are embedded in genre the way that we are more regularly aware of short fiction than other types of readers are. Mm-hmm. But I think your standard person who goes to libraries or puts things on their Kindle or goes into a bookstore, they're looking for novels. You know, they're looking for like sustained works of fiction. And this idea of individual stories that can stand apart, but are part of kind of constructing an understanding of this character and an understanding of that character's world, kind of thread the needle between the trend of what consumers of fiction consume and what an author might really prefer to explore, to kind of like try out a character in a lot of different sort of scenarios, test them and kind of explore them. And I think that consolidating them in a package that will feel novel-esque, but have that kind of like episodic exploration quality to it, I think that's a good way to sort of thread a needle to kind of bring people to the place that you've gotten to in understanding this character.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. That is kind of the idea. I have always done a lot of my world building for all of my various projects through short fiction. Mm-hmm. Because short fiction is such an experimental place, you can play around with ideas in a more efficient way than if I were to write a whole book about it, right? A whole book takes like a year at least to kind of get a draft out. And I don't know, people can do it faster, I suppose, but I can only really do it in
you get annoying things like a job and kids.
Honestly, what I do is I can draft a novel in an entire summer because that's when I do all my writing because I'm a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so like during the year, I can't really do much, but during the summer I could draft a novel. But that's like the whole summer. Like that's it. That's all I can do. And that's only one idea you can really play with. So short fiction is a really useful experimental space. And even with If Wishes Were Retail, I had played with that world several different times in other ways, not with the genie, but with other creatures and other sort of like absurd, you know, liminal fantasy kind of like what if a dragon had to downsize kind of like issues, you know, and so, I always have done that. And so Faceless, I always wanted to write a novel in Faceless's universe. But I felt that the universe was so complex and weird, I needed to explore it first. And that's where most of these stories came from, was a way of preparing myself for inserting myself into this, the union of stars, this sort of interstellar civilization that doesn't work like most other interstellar civilizations in space opera we see, and then it's decentralized and there's no like empire. There's just like, you know, there's kind of a weird food chain thing going on. And yeah, but when I had them all, I was like, you know, this would actually make a pretty good way to introduce readers to the character and the whole world. And it has there is an arc of sorts. Like Faceless is a different creature at the end than it is at the beginning of the story, for sure. It's been fundamentally changed by its experience with civilization. And it has, I would argue, become, even though it insists on its own immorality, I think it is a more moral character at the end, or at least it's more, maybe ethical is the right word to use. It has a sense of ethics that it didn't have before, in that it is willing to recognize the concept of innocence, and it's willing to understand that maybe not everybody deserves what they get, you know, like, so, you know, it has standards. I think it develops standards. And I think that's a building block, and that, like, if I were permitted to keep going with the Faceless saga, in the novel in particular, it goes through enormous changes. And then, like, I have ideas for another book or two. Yeah. Will you ever read them? I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. But, every author's got a trunk full of unrealized dreams, right? So,
thank God you didn't say bodies.
No.
Oh,
no.
I mean, possibly. I don't know. Like, yeah.
Metaphorical bodies.
Yeah, that one.
But anyway, yeah, I think it is pretty accessible. I think it is a really good hybrid. Though I have had some people read it and get mad that I, in various stories, explain things again that they already know.
Oh, well, because, like, these had homes elsewhere first.
Yeah, I did actually go back through when I was editing it and remove a bunch of that, but I couldn't really remove all of it.
Yeah.
Because then it wouldn't really be true to the original publications. And of course, you know, I give a lot of credit to the, you know, all the, in the book, all the original publications are cited, and you know, like, this came from Analog and stuff. And there's only so much I would be willing to change something that was previously published elsewhere, just because of a sense of continuity, I suppose. Right? Like, if you had read the story in Analog and you bought the book because you wanted the story in the Analog that you loved from Analog, I would like you to have that story in its mostly unchanged form.
Yeah.
So I couldn't take all that out. And so, like, yeah, if you really like novels, and you're like, I don't know about short stories, I will say, like, this still is novel-esque, as you say, Tracy, but there are places where you'll be like, oh, well, he already explained that. It's like, well, yeah, because that was published like 4 years before this one was, like, in a totally different magazine. So, yeah, I needed to explain it again. So,
and I think, like, this is like the scale of this is completely different. As Patrick knows, I'm kind of bad at being on the cutting edge of things. Like, I'm kind of notorious for, like, I'll get around to reading and watching the things that matter, but, like, I'm going to be anywhere from like 5 to 10 years behind a lot of people on that stuff.
And that's how I am with video games. Yeah.
Right. And so, like, I've been for the last year kind of roaring my way through the Expanse series. Obviously,
the
like
show, the TV show.
No, both. I've been reading them too.
Yeah, I know. But I wanted to make a point that you are watching the TV show.
Yes, yes. And so I am now at the point where I've been at it for long enough with the books that I'm aware of the fact that they know the cumulative organism that, as James S. A. Corey, they know that there are readers who are going to pick up somewhere along the way, and they may kind of miss the bus of a previous volume. And so there is frequently this kind of, like, I'm going to remind you of who this person is, or I'm going to remind you of what these things were. And granted, that's happening in part because there's like 18 months or 2 years in between the publications of some of these books. And also because the books are like 500-600 pages. They're quite massive. But there is, I think, yeah, can a reader get irritated with a sort of like, I knew that already. But like, well, I mean, do you remember the era in which we did television and it was like previously on? And it was
still doing that.
Right. Like, you know, even with stuff where they stream the whole damn season at once, they're still going to do that opening montage with like, here are the five scenes that we want you to know we're going to do some kind of callback to here. And so I think that revisiting those moments, even if they've got a slightly grouchy reader, is ultimately to the benefit of that reader, because it's also you as an author. Like, we're always trying to teach people how to read our books.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult thing to do without, like, how much am I going to steer you? Like, I need to keep my hands off, but I also need to be like, over here a little bit. And
It was a particular challenge with Faceless in that. So, you know, Faceless is essentially in its natural form is a blob. And it's a series of
we prefer gelatinous cube.
No, it is not gelatinous. And that's important because it is a series of layered muscular membranes that are able, almost like if I don't use this term because Faceless would be on its first person narration and Faceless has no basis for comparison. It's almost like if you took your loofah in your shower, but made all those little strands, thick strands of muscle. And that loofah material covered an interior bag that was full of extremely caustic chemicals.
And it becomes very good at killing people.
Well, it is very good at killing people. Yeah. But like in order to get people to understand what it's like to be faceless, because this is a first person narration, Faceless has to sort of explain how it works in the universe. It can see every direction at the same time. It can only hold certain shapes for as long as it can keep its muscular membranes tense for that period of time. Like, it has no centralized organs. So like, you can shoot it in what you think it's its head, but its head is really not any more vital than any other part of its body. So, you know, so on and so forth. And so with each story, I kind of layer on a different sort of experiment in Faceless's physiology. Like, there's the story where it's on the water planet and it absolutely hates being on the water planet because it has so much trouble balancing itself. Because the floor is always moving and it doesn't have an inner ear in the way that we have, and it doesn't have a skeleton. So like, every time the boat moves, its head sloshes a little. And if you're looking at it, you would know instantly there's something wrong with that guy. His head is moving in a weird way.
Some uncanny shit going on here.
And so like, it keeps tripping the uncanny valley for everyone around it, and it drives it nuts. So it has to spend all its time basically in the bilge of these ships where no one's looking at it, which it doesn't enjoy. And so like, you know, every story involves a new familiarizing yourself with being a very alien creature.
By the way, hold on. Yeah. So I want to go back to what you were talking about with the over-explanation kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
And what you're seeing in The Expanse, which was done 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever.
First book was more than 10. Yeah.
I was talking about the show.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Show.
There's the new thing in television for the dual screens where they are like the networks and the people, the production companies, the people in charge are specifically telling the shows and movies and different things to dumb it down and make it so that someone who is
watching a show
doom scrolling doesn't have to pay that much attention. And so they will actually have characters explaining everything that just happened for the listener, right? For the person who's not paying attention. My question for both of you is, do we think, like, is that going to become a thing since audiobooks are so popular now? Is that going to become a thing that gets pushed into the novel sphere, the short story sphere, the writer sphere, where these huge corporations that publish books and novels and different things start wanting the same thing out of the novel, out of the story, for the same reason, because someone is doing something at the same time as they're quote unquote reading the book, because they're doing the audiobook, right? So you might have someone who is cleaning while they're listening to the audiobook, or working out, or running, or doing this or doing that. Like there is the distracted audiobook listening that's happening. Yeah. I do it. I listen to audiobooks while I'm working.
So Ken Liu wrote a short story. You know, you're familiar with Ken Liu, right?
Never heard of him.
Yeah. Troll.
No, yeah, yeah. Ken Liu wrote a short story that was published in an anthology that I also happen to have a short story.
Isn't he just a translator?
He is not just a translator. He writes his own stuff, too. Yeah. He's a very talented guy. He published a story in a collection called The Digital Aesthete, which is an excellent collection, by the way. It's probably one of the best collections I've ever personally been a part of. And like, you shouldn't buy it just for my story, though that's fine. If you like me that much, I won't object. But there's so many good stories in that collection. It's very, very good. Ken Liu did a story called Good Stories. And it's this deeply chilling look at, you know, the day after tomorrow. And it's discussing the impact of AI on art, as is like basically the entire collection is all about. It was ironically like my story in that anthology was written just before the OpenAI thing really hit. But anyway, Ken Liu's was written just after, because he wrote it like a few months after I did, I assume. And one of the things, so there's all these people in the story who don't read, but they take AI generated books and use that raw material to generate AI derived movies that they get to star in. And it's like a whole hobby, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. And the main character is this author, this former author, who then got a job at like being a proofreader, essentially, for an AI factory. And she meets these people and is talking to them. And one of them says, you know, authors are the most arrogant human beings alive. They insist on 100% of their audience's attention for an extended period of time, 8, 9, 10 hours. How dare they? And I was like, and I'm paraphrasing, he doesn't exactly say it that way, but pretty much that's what they say. And I was like, first of all, that's absolutely accurate. Yes. We are supremely arrogant. We want your undivided attention for X number of hours. And so that's true. But I also don't think that's a bad thing. And I also have no interest in catering to people who are only halfway paying attention. If you're only halfway paying attention, then I don't want you to understand what's going on.
That's your punishment.
I'm sorry. You can either pay attention to this. I do the same thing in my classes when I teach. It's like, you can either pay attention to the stuff I say and take notes, or don't. Your grade will reflect whatever you decide to do. And like, if you enjoy, you know, half listening to something, then my work is not for you. And I think a lot of people's work is not for you. I think especially science fiction is not for you. I think science fiction is not for you, because science fiction demands enormous amounts of attention, because what you're doing is absolutely recreating reality, and you need people to pay attention in order for that to work. And if you're not willing to pay attention, then man, there's a lot of cozy mysteries out there that you'd love, and you just go ahead and read that stuff. Like, and I don't want to knock cozy mysteries. Sorry, that's sure. Maybe mean. But like, you know what I mean? Like, there's plenty of police procedurals that like, or, you know, by the numbers thrillers that like, you know, you've read a dozen of them, and that, you know, it's the same character. You always know this character. You know exactly how the story is supposed to work. Like, take any number of Bond novels where you're like, okay, I basically know this deal. Like, I'm just gonna, and you don't have to pay that much attention. Great. Just do that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think an author or artist writ large at this point in time, and I don't think maybe this was ever true, but I definitely don't think it's true now, where you can assume that you're going to capture the entire market. Like, that's just not going to happen anymore. We're such a bifurcated, compartmentalized market. Everybody's got their own little niche. I mean, look at Tracy watching a show that was over 5 years ago. Like, you know, like I, like How am I supposed to predict that? Like, maybe someday someone will pick up this book in 10 years and be like, this is the greatest thing ever. How am I have no idea who that person's going to be, and I can't even really predict it. So I think dual screening, which is the concept that Patrick's talking about. I've read some articles about it. The idea of dual screening is definitely present, and I think it's going to shape how we approach things so long as the internet and our media environment persists in the way that it does, which is we all watch our own things in our own time. Asterisk, I'm not certain that's a good thing, by the way. I don't think everybody needs to worry about it. And I don't know, maybe the market for people paying attention will disappear, but I don't think so. I think there's plenty of people out there who still are.
I will throw out, I'm old enough to remember when you would be watching TV and someone would come on and some member of your family would go, I know that person. Like, I know them. Where do I know them from? And everybody would scratch their heads and go, I don't know. I don't recognize them. No, I know it. And then would drive everyone in their life crazy for the next month going, have you seen such and such movie? Do you know who that one person like? Yeah. And versus now where you grab your phone and you go cast the movie name. And then all pops up and you go, oh, there's that person. And you click it and then you see everything they've ever done.
And I think part of how I would answer the question of, you know, the dual screening that you raised, Patrick, is kind of related to our need for immediacy, like our need for we want answers more quickly. We want clarity more quickly. We want all these things more quickly. So to the point you made, Austin, about like speculative fiction in particular, usually doesn't reward a kind of half-assed paying attention. Like there's just too much going on. There's too many details that are going to matter in some way later to build up our understanding of this unknown. In the class that I teach in the spring, the speculative fiction studies class, because I use a lot of short fiction that's published online, and a lot of online magazines also have podcast components to them now where certain select stories they will do audio versions of. I get a lot of students now who are super excited by the fact that they can read off a screen, they could print it out if they want to be super Luddite, or they can like do the podcast version of it. And every single one of them who listens to it in audiobook does 2 or 2.5 times speed narration.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Which I like, the very idea is crazy making to me.
Because Bernardo does that.
There's a reason they chose the reader they did. There's a reason the reader is doing things the way they are. And if you're hearing them as like a cast member of Alvin and the Chipmunks, then perhaps that is not translating. But what matters to them is the ability not just to take that in, because probably they are like scrolling while listening to the thing, or, you know, running while listening to the thing, or doing whatever they're doing while listening to the thing. It's also trying to do it in the most efficient way possible. And I think that a lot of what we, and I mean like the people, like people who are minded like us, are struggling with right now is that we live in a world that has increasingly incentivized rapidity and efficiency. And in the course of incentivizing those things, it's a lot of baby out with the bathwater. And I think that we are rightfully concerned about, there was a baby there. Hang on.
And this is not
flying out the window now.
This is not anything new. Yeah. Robert can correct me. Robert, our patron, can correct me. I believe it was over 25 years ago, Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda debuted. Mm. It was a great show. It's a great show. And I was very excited. I watched the whole season. I was like, man, this is great. And then season 2 came along and I went, what the fuck happened to this show? What is going on?
Was that the one with
And it turned
Sorbo?
Out, it turned out it was Kevin Sorbo himself.
Oh, really?
He
ruined
show.
Everything.
Yes.
Fucking Kevin
show.
Sorbo.
He's in the show and he's complaining the whole time that he doesn't understand anything. He doesn't understand that any of it. It's hard to follow.
He don't do a reading comprehension.
Because he's the star and he's the name that is like quote unquote bringing people to watch the show, he got like a bunch of people fired and he got the show retooled and he dumbed it down to make it easier on him to understand. No. And he thought that that was better. And from that point on, that show was terrible, in my opinion. Like, it just, it was awful. So this has been going on for a long time. Yeah. Now it's getting worse. Though. Anyway, we're running out of time. Tracy.
We are. This, that's a bad taste to have in our mouths right there. Kevin Sorbo and ruining things, which feels to me like a good time to do Picks of the Week.
We'll get to Picks of the Week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, Picks of the Week.
All right. So, Patrick, you need to pick something that doesn't involve Kevin Sorbo. Go.
Okay. I actually have two that I could pick. One of them is I kind of added for Austin because of some stuff you said in the green room.
Yeah.
So the first one is a documentary on Netflix called Who Killed the Expos?
Oh.
And this is all about – and Tracy, you and I talked about this a little bit.
Yeah, we did for the Just Us episode.
The Just Us episode. But I didn't go into it in a lot of detail because I hadn't got to see it yet. Mm-hmm. And this is about – the Expos, the Montreal Expos, and what happened to them as a team and why they ended up being the Washington Nationals eventually. It's a great documentary. Apparently, I think it was originally in French because of Quebec.
Yeah.
So there it's overdubbed in English, but it's great. And it goes into all of the things that happened and like how the, was it 94? I believe 94 or 95 Expos were like the greatest team and they were on their way to winning the World Series. And then
I don't
the
remember
baseball
the year,
strike.
But they were really good in the 90s. Yeah.
And then
yeah.
the baseball strike happened.
Yeah.
And killed their season. And then when they came back, money issues happened. And the guy who was running it just started dumping
sell
all
for
of
pieces.
The expensive yeah. people that were going to cost them too much money. And so he just started trading them and destroyed the team in a way that hasn't been seen since until the Rockies, right? Because the Rockies leadership are so fucking stupid and I hate them. And I wish that they would sell the team to somebody who cares.
There's a lot of teams out there that have basically decapitated themselves.
Oh my God. The Rockies
like, you know, the late 90s Marlins did it.
Well, that's what's funny.
The Red Sox have done it numerous times throughout their history.
They're like, we'll do it better this time.
Yeah. The guy, I believe it was the Marlins, the guy who ended up buying and being the managing partner of the Expos and then getting rid of all the other partners and then eventually selling it to Major League Baseball because no one else would buy it. So he sold it to Major League Baseball so that he could buy the Marlins and move to Florida.
Oh, no.
That was his deal. So that's a good one. It's on Netflix. If you love baseball, if you love that stuff, go over there. If you really love baseball, don't watch the Rockies. And the other one is also on Netflix. It's a new animated series. It's Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell.
That
is really good.
It's so fucking good.
Nice. Animated. It feels like you're in the game. There's people like sneaking around with the night vision things on and killing people and shit's happening and there's the conspiracy and it's just really good stuff. So check out that one as well. Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell on Netflix.
Fantastic. All right. So Austin, how about you?
I'm going to pick a video game. Nice. So I have been playing this game. It's on multiple platforms, I think, but I've been playing it on the old Switch, not the Switch 2, because I haven't got one yet. But it's called UFO 50.
Okay.
And it is this game. It is a meta game, almost. It is, imagine, so like, this is going to be a weird explanation. Imagine if there was a competing 8-bit video game company in the era of Nintendo and Sega called UFO Games.
Okay.
Imagine if someone had been such a fan of that series of games that they went and collected 50 of those games and put them in one downloadable emulator that you can use on your modern system. Okay. That is exactly what they have done.
So it's an emulator for things that never existed.
It is 50 completely new, you've never played them before, 8-bit video games, complete with credits and animations, the whole entire thing. And here's a wild thing. It assumes, because these games were classics in their day, that you know how to play them and offers no instructions on how to play the game. And it has every kind of game imaginable. It has like fiendishly hard shooters. It's got strategy games. It's got like an old Final Fantasy-esque RPG. It's got
platformers.
Like, it's got platformers. It's got puzzle games. It's got a deck builder in there. It is, and they're like, some of them are absolutely unplayably hard. Some of them are some of the best games I've played in a long time. They're all 8-bit graphics and very simple gameplay so that you can figure them out kind of on your own. It doesn't take that much. And also on top of that, they've created an entire fictional universe in which this exists. So like all the, you see like the writing credits when you win a game, you get the writing credits and stuff. You see that person who I don't think is a real person show up again in the other games. And like they create, like there's visual motifs that kind of wed through all 50 games. We want to talk something that isn't for short attention spans. This game is definitely it, but it's really cool. It is like one of the cooler things I've ever seen done in the video game space. And it was cheap as hell. I think I got it for like, I don't know, under $20. And I'm going to be playing this game for scores of hours because like there, you know, you finish one game and you're like, oh, where this one is. Oh, this is totally different, but also really cool. And it's just excellent game design and really, really, really neat. And I highly recommend it. UFO 50.
Nice.
Downloadable on multiple platforms and probably PC too, but I don't know.
That's awesome. Really cool. That's
out there in my circle of friends. There's some excitement now because Halo Combat Evolved has been completely remastered and it's going to be released on PlayStation as well as Steam and Xbox.
That was one of my top five gaming experiences.
It looks really, really nice. If you look at the trailer for it, it looks incredible. So, yeah. So that's coming back. Tracy.
So I do have a pick. It is a book. It is a book. Yeah. In fact, because this episode is going to drop in the final week of October, and because we ended up taking a kind of break from recording for about a month from the middle of September into now the end of October, this means that this is my only opportunity to make the recommendation that I make every October. Y'all need to read Roger Zelazny's A Night in the Lonesome October. And for those of you who have not heard me talk about this for like 5 years straight every October, we're going to do it again. So this is one of Zelazny's last works before he passed away in 1995. And the premise of the book is that it is 31 chapters long. And the idea is you read a chapter a night in the month of October. And there are this collection of characters who, not a spoiler to say this, you rapidly figure out many of them are drawn from various places in pre-existing horror universe. So like there is the good doctor who is clearly Victor Frankenstein and his creation. There is the count who is clearly Dracula. There is a character named
Frankenstein.
Yeah. There's a character named Jack who's pretty clearly Jack the Ripper, and so on and so on. And there are these characters and their animal companions who have all gathered to this space outside of London because they are playing the game with a capital G. And the game is played only once every so often when there is a certain alignment of the literal stars and cosmic forces. And you find out over time, because talk about something that you have to pay attention to. Although they're tiny chapters and you're only reading one a night, Zelazny is not holding your hand here. He is expecting you to figure it out. You figure out within, you know, the equivalent of the first 2 weeks of reading that there is a cosmic event that is going to happen, and half of them are allied on the side of preventing the cosmic event from happening, and the other half are trying to make it happen. And that it is ultimately part of the larger Cthulhu universe, that this is actually a Lovecraftian story. And so I won't say anything more for fear of spoiling things, but over time, you with the characters discover things about who is allied with whom and who has been juking each other out. And in like all Zelazny texts, there's a lot of like doublespeak and sort of like political kind of backstabbery and interesting things going on. It also has a wry sense of humor, and it is told best of all from the perspective of Jack the Ripper's dog, Snuff.
That sounds fantastic.
So, it is wonderful. It's a delightful read. Every October I pull it out and, you know, I try to read a chapter a night. Some weeks are busy, so I might have to like plow ahead and read like four extra chapters to make sure, because this next week it's going to be crazy and I don't want to fall behind. But I'm very much looking forward to once again reaching the end of A Night in Lonesome October. And if you're like, oh, dang, I'm going to be listening to this episode on the 28th of October, it's too late. It's never too late. Just read the frickin' book. Your library probably has it.
Very cool.
All right. So we did it. We're off of hiatus. We're back. We've come back with a bang with Austin, and he's brought us Faceless Galaxy. So if you're looking to have something that feels dark, noir-y, and speculative in all the biggest possible ways, you should check that out. Where should people find their Faceless Galaxy or you in this big, broad world?
So it's available kind of anywhere books are sold online. You won't find many copies in bookstores, but it is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I'll give a particular shout out to bookshop.org because they support independent bookstores. So if you want to buy a book online, but you don't want to put money in Jeff Bezos's pocket, there's always bookshop.org. As for myself, you can find me on aahabershaw.com. Which is where I keep people apprised of my various movements and activities. Thanks so much for having me on.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry. Do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.